Thank you for listening to the Institute of World Politics podcast. To learn more about our graduate programs in national security, international affairs, and intelligence, or to support our work in educating future leaders, please visit www.iwp.edu.
Hello. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Institute of World Politics one-hour seminar on winning without war. The Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C. has an informal motto, which is educating diplomats, warriors, and spies for the 21st century. Our idea is to make sure that America is strong and independent and powerful and wins any challenge without war. My name is Michael Maybach. I was hired by the founders of the Intel Corporation way back in 1983. And spent most of my career as a vice president of the Intel Corporation. After that, I was the president of the European American Business Council, and now I'm in service of civic and other organizations, including serving on the IWP Board of Trustees. I am a graduate of IWP, so I can speak highly of what a fine education one gets at IWP. Today, we're going to survey the 21st century challenges to America's leadership in the world and how to meet those challenges. The ocean of history brings to every generation new and powerful waves. The questions are, what are the critical dimensions of these threats we face today, these waves that are crashing upon us on our shores? They include the challenge of China, a resurgent Russia, nuclear weapons in Iran and North Korea, radical Islam, and now a global pandemic, something we haven't seen in 100 years. Questions are not, are these challenges real or must we deal with them? They are real and we must deal with them. The questions really are, what are the critical dimensions of these threats? Who understands them and who will have future leaders prepared not only to survive, but master these historic waves? And of course, we want that to be the case with American leaders. So in other words, can America win without war? Here to discuss these challenges and winning without war are John Lenchowski, our founder and president of the Institute of World Politics, Dr. Frank Marlowe, our academic dean, and Dr. David Glancy, a professor at IWP as well. So I have three questions, gentlemen, and I'm going to go through those one by one with you. First of all, thank you for joining us to speak with our audience. Please offer more details about the challenges America face and what it means to win without war. John, would you like to start?
Well, I would first like to observe that the whole concept of winning without war is a very ancient one. The famous Chinese sage Sun Tzu, who was the author of the famous book, The Art of War, wrote in that book that to defeat one's enemy without the use of force is the acme of skill. We here in the United States however many of us have read that book, our foreign policy and national security culture in the United States has not taken that particular aphorism seriously. And we tend to have developed a materialistic foreign policy culture, which focuses principally on arms and money and the diplomacy concerning arms and money. In other words, the instruments of hard power, to the neglect of many of the instruments of soft power that are amongst those that have to be employed if we want to have an integrated strategy that can enable us to protect our interests and prevail, if necessary, in international conflicts without having to go to war to do so. We at IWP take this aphorism of Sun Tzu very seriously, and we may be amongst the only schools in the United States that actually teaches our students how to win without war. And so a lot of this has to do with paying attention to the many different arts of statecraft, which is our term referring to the different instruments of national power, military, economic, diplomacy, public diplomacy, the various forms of strategic influence, and including non-violent warfare, political warfare, psychological warfare, ideological warfare, and so on, as well as other instruments, intelligence, counterintelligence, cyber strategy, and so on and so forth. And so we study these matters in the context of current challenges to the United States, such as that of rising China. And I believe that if we pay attention to some of the lessons of history, particularly some of the lessons of the Cold War, where not all the time, but some of the time, we conducted some of the key instruments in that orchestra, we were able to win that war without firing a shot, so to speak, although there were proxy wars, of course. But some of the decisive elements that we used have been systematically neglected, and we at IWP are trying to keep up an institutional memory of the best practices in these different arts of statecraft so that we can keep the peace, defend our interests and our way of life.
Thank you. Frank Marlow, would you like to comment?
Sure. Let me say it's a pleasure to be here. To build off of what John had said, I think the other approach you have to take is to look at we have to win without war because our opponents are trying to win without war. Our opponents are not launching major military incursions, a couple of notable exceptions, but for the most part, that's not the way they're behaving. The threats are not solely military. In fact, our chief adversaries are behaving in such a way as to take actions that are deliberately below the threshold at which we are willing to take military action. Many have heard the term hybrid war. That is exactly the kind of approach they're taking. They're going right up to that edge, but then stopping. Getting us to a point where we just can't quite justify using military force for something that really isn't major enough to justify it.
What we used to call brinksmanship.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. And they are taking approaches that are very old approaches, but ones that are quite effective. A lot of people refer to it as the salami slicing tactic, right? You take just a little and keep going back time after time, but never a big enough chunk that that you spark that major counter reaction.
Very good. David?
And I think, both, again, thank you for hosting, Michael. Thanks for our audience for listening in today. Appreciate what John and Frank have talked about. And I think there's a real problem with a lot of leaders and policymakers where, and even the general public, we see conflict too often in the U.S. as being black or white. We either at peace or we're at war, meaning, military conflict with another state. There's a whole range gray area of competition to conflict, sometimes with allies, even economic competition, but it gets more and more aggressive when we're talking about our adversaries and harsher competitors. And so being able to compete in this area of competition conflict, the U.S. over the last 20, 30 years really hasn't been on the field. We've relied on the military far too often. And we've often not had a strategic approach to some of these major challenges. And that's led to a loss of life and the loss of both blood and treasure. And it's gotten us to use the military more than we probably should have. So, what we're talking about are going back to some of the instruments of statecraft and putting together a strategy so that you don't have to use the military force. You can shape the international environment in a way that is beneficial to the U.S. and our allies without actually having to use the military. And it's understandable leaders you know, the military can provide decisive impact, and the results are readily apparent. The use of some of these other instruments of statecraft can take time, and they're harder to measure the effectiveness. But if it's done in a coordinated fashion over time, they can be very successful.
Very good. Thank you. I want to go to the second question we have for you today. Having suggested why it's so important to win without war, and I've liked all three of your sort of focuses on that, including the hybrid war, brinksmanship, and this sort of life is not black and white, as David pointed out. Why is it so important to win without war? My next question is, how America can win without war? What are the things we're doing that we have to keep doing better? What are the things we're not doing so well? You know, for example, the president's announced the Space Force. I wonder if we should have a biogenetics force now that we have this pandemic. So, John, what are your thoughts about what America needs to be doing now to step up its game?
Well, thank you, Michael. One thing I would like to stress is the importance that we maintain a credible military deterrent, that we maintain strength across the board. You know, George Washington and others have said that the best way to preserve the peace is to prepare for war. And one of the greatest mistakes that one can make in attempting to achieve peace is to send the bad guys around the world signals of weakness, and many ways of sending them. And one of them, of course, is to neglect the acquisition of arms, neglect training, neglect readiness, and to be behind the eight ball when it comes to the development of technological capabilities. And then one has to be able to send out signals of strength. And strength, of course, are not only materially in terms of having that military power as an ultimate backstop, but maintaining one's economic vibrancy, and perhaps most importantly, maintaining the moral, political, ideological strength of the nation, which is what sends a decisive signal of strength to the world. It is a signal of one's will to defend oneself. And if we are so internally divided, if our adversaries come to the conclusion that so many of the elites of our country hate our country because we once had slavery, as if nobody else in the world had slavery.
Everybody else in the world
had Western civilization that was the one that got rid of slavery, and not the others. And so having what I consider to be a morally ordered and informed patriotism, and being able, which is the demonstration of that will to defend oneself, sending that signal to the world is absolutely decisive. And so I think that, you know, developing the one place, there are some places where we have not developed strength. We have been extremely weak over decades in the whole field of counterintelligence. We permit foreign spies to just have the run of this country. We've been incredibly weak in this. We give out visas. We let foreign spies. There are 25,000 Chinese intelligence collectors in Silicon Valley alone. This is breathtaking. It is beyond the scope of anything that occurred during the Cold War, and that doesn't even count the cyber espionage that's been going on.
And to add to this, John, just some people that say, let's just have open borders completely. My gosh, nothing here to defend.
That's right. Anyway, there are having a capability, a diplomatic capability, not only to have good relations with governments, but to have good relations with people, and to ensure that that foreign public opinion is not disinformed about us, and that we cultivate sympathizers around the world with American ideals and with the reality of America. And when we have those sympathizers, it's another form of a tremendous form of strength.
David wanted to make a comment.
No, I think I really appreciate your comments, John. And absolutely, the military, that's something through history we've learned, and the Byzantine Empire and others, having a strong military is important to being successful diplomacy and with your other activities. Allies are hugely important. Being able to cultivate and have strong allied relations, being able to communicate and talk to other populations around the world that we can share an understanding, that's going to be hugely important. Last week I read a report that a Chinese diplomat had noted that in the competition conflict between the U.S., the side that was going to win was going to be the one that had the most friends. And I thought that was an interesting point. And it should be a strength of the U.S., where we have goodwill. We've done lots of good things for the world, but we also have to work on that. If you don't work on your allied relationships, you don't work on your public diplomacy, they definitely atrophy. And so, this is something where having strong alliances, having strong friends, that helps promote the economic freedom, diplomacy or democracy, and that's great for the world. Yeah. I think if we could we get back to just talk about some of the threats that we've seen and that we're, going to be facing, and possibly Frank, could you talk about that a little?
Sure. I mean, I think the way I was going to approach this is before you start answering the question of how to do it, the first thing you got to do is understand what is it you're dealing with, and what do you define as success, right? In my view, you can look at Russia, you look at China, you look at all the threats, Michael, that you laid out at the outset here. But what they all amount to, ultimately, fundamentally, is about what is the future of the global system going to look like, right? What we're seeing right now is arguably one of the most sustained attacks in decades on the basic functioning of the rules that we understand and take for granted today on how the international system works. So you're seeing the subversion or the replacement of international organizations and international bodies, whether you're talking about the Chinese intimidating the World Health Organization, as we saw a few months ago, whether you're seeing creation of rival institutions like the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank as a way of sidelining the IMF and the World Bank, right?
Belt and Road and South China Sea.
Yeah, Belt and Road to some degree in terms of attempting to create a new sort of international economic order. But the deliberate use of methods to try to subvert international organizations. Think about the efforts that the Chinese are undertaking to marginalize ASEAN, right? So that ASEAN can't take a firm stand against them. Look at what the Russians are trying to do, developing inroads with some of our Eastern European and Turkey allies try to marginalize NATO. Okay, the point here is to take international organizations that we've counted on and make them useless, right? Because they know most Americans generally talk well about these organizations and want to work through these organizations.
Yeah.
Another thing they're trying to do is reorganize the global economic system. You're seeing a return of mercantilism and neocolonialism, right? Particularly in Africa, the Chinese have been incredibly active and are doing incredible damage to the peoples of those countries. You're also seeing effort on the Russians' part to use pipeline politics as a way of reorganizing international economic activity in a way that benefits the Russian state. And then finally, I think you're seeing an attack on the general rules-based order that we've taken into account, whether it's Chinese efforts to take over vast amounts of international waters in the South China Sea, whether you're talking about Russia and China attempting to create a condominium of some kind in the Arctic, where the Russians have made incredibly grandiose claims of continental shelf control over what is essentially international water in the in the Arctic Ocean. These are huge, huge issues, and it's fundamentally about who's going to set the rules for how nations are going to behave over the next 100 years.
Excellent. David, do you want to add to that, or should we go to the next question?
If you don't mind, and I do think that, you know, these challenges are across the board, and it's, you know, you mentioned the Iranian nuclear, it's also Iranian political warfare and support of proxies and support of favorable elements and governments around the region that are against the U.S. interests and those of our allies. Frank mentioned the Russians and the Chinese activities. You know, I'd also throw in the Russian efforts to, you know, support separatist movements and turmoil within states, as well as breaking up and causing tensions within the European Union and NATO. And, you know, again, this is something that the Soviets did, trying to drive a wedge between the U.S. and our allies in the 80s and before that. And we're seeing this behavior again. And so, you know, it's across the board. It's political, it's economic, it's informational, it's diplomatic. And, you know, we do need to refocus, I think, on our national security establishment and on these threats, and, you know, not just defer to, well, there's a military solution. While, again, you know, certainly keeping the military strong and having that as a last resort if we need it so that we can win decisively. But that's these other areas are going to need attention. And this is something, you know, that unfortunately we don't have a lot of leaders and people actually working in the foreign policy establishment that necessarily understand our history, understand these instruments of statecraft and how they're used. And this can have real world implications and problems. Just two examples, and I'll let you go on to the further questions, but these things have a real impact. Back in 2005, reportedly President Bush decided to not have the U.S., after initially starting to support moderate elements in the Iraq elections, that the U.S. ended up withdrawing support and not having any role in supporting moderate elements in the Iraqi elections, all the while the Iranians were supporting their proxies. So the U.S. wasn't on the field. The moderates narrowly lost, and we weren't anywhere to be involved. If, you know, and this was President Bush's, reportedly President Bush's decision after some pushback from Capitol Hill. But this is, you know, the U.S. did take a role in Italian elections after World War II to try to keep the communists out of power. This is something that states do. And, you know, I hate to kind of have revisionist history, but what would the Middle East look like over the last 15 years if moderates had won that first election in 2005 in Iraq? So, you know, that has real world consequences. The Obama administration not necessarily seeing the Russians as a threat or how they might react to or perceive the U.S., not doing enough to be aware of or counter, or at least kind of understand that the Russians might take actions against the U.S. and how they might do that. I think we're seeing some of the consequences of that. So these are real world implications and real world situations where not understanding our history, not understanding how instruments of statecraft can be used, not understanding who our adversaries are, can have a decisive impact. And really, they do matter.
This is all very helpful. I think one of the messages our audience is hearing is, it isn't that you have a civilian economy and then you have a defense department. You have lots of agencies and pieces of government, including Track 3 organizations, et cetera, but all the tools of diplomacy and statecraft. And war really, in part, is sort of a failure of all those. What we want to do is win without war, as we're saying. This moves us nicely to our third question before we open this up to audience questions, and that is, what do future leaders need to know and to do successfully to counter some of the challenges we've discussed? What do they need to know and how to do those things? John, we're going to start with you, and then Frank, and then David.
Well, I think that what is really important is to understand the strategic environment and understand the genetic code, particularly of our adversaries. You know, one of the principal, the first thing that you do in foreign policy is you figure out who your friends and your adversaries are. And then you can begin to construct some kind of an architecture for how you deal with what the adversaries are doing. One dimension of the current reality that I haven't really, I don't think we've mentioned much about, is the degree to which the Chinese have exercised extraordinary influence within our country because of their strategy of enriching certain people and sectors of our economy and politically neutralizing them. The Soviets tried doing this during the Cold War, and they succeeded with some people. But because we've left the door so open to the Chinese, you have vast sectors of our economy that is essentially almost owned by the Chinese and have been politically neutralized. And so you have former secretaries of state, secretaries of defense, and even directors of central intelligence who have been directly or indirectly on Beijing's payroll and who've been downplaying any threat from China for the last five administrations. And it wasn't until this administration came along that people started telling some truth about all of this.
Yeah.
And so one has to understand the strategic environment. You have to understand what are the strategic intentions and purposes, particularly of your adversaries. You have to understand what I like to call the fastballs, the curveballs, and the knuckleballs that they can throw at us, which is what are their instruments of statecraft? What can we expect? When I came into government in the Reagan State Department in 1981, the U.S. intelligence community was not collecting any intelligence on Soviet propaganda, disinformation, and active measures, which was the KGB term referring to disinformation, forgeries, covert influence operations, and the like. And it's amazing to me when a large part of the Cold War was fought on that battlefield that we weren't paying any attention to it. And so one has to really face the realities of this global strategic environment first. Then you have to study systematically and learn how to deal with each dimension of it, which is why, neglected instruments like counterintelligence, public diplomacy, and strategic influence, the counterintelligence being a fundamentally defensive measure, the public diplomacy and strategic influence being offensive measures, and certain different aspects of economic strategy, which are both offensive and defensive. But all of these have been neglected. And so what we at IWP try to do is teach all of them so that all of our students are aware of the different sections of the orchestra, the different instruments.
Right.
And that is what's absolutely key.
And some of this is coming up now, the Confucius Institutes, Chinese news agencies are no longer seen as true press agencies. Chinese students in major research and development labs, our trade policy, which unfortunately over many administrations, ever since China got in the WTO, was simply not demanding that the Chinese live up to the WTO commitments, et cetera.
That's right.
We'll go to you next. And then
sure. I certainly couldn't disagree with anything John said. I think that's all absolutely critical, sorts of things that future leaders need to know. A couple of the things I think they need to keep in mind. The analogy I always give is you can't win a football game if your team never crosses half field, right? At some point, you have to transition to the strategic offensive. We play defense. We see ourselves as defensive people. We don't like seeing ourselves as being assertive or forward or with a forward agenda, certainly not one that seems strategically competitive to an adversary. We don't like playing that as Americans. We have to. Every lesson of history says if all you do is play defense, you're going to lose in the end. And you have to make a decision.
In Democracy in America, Tocqueville talks about this. Because we're an egalitarian society, we tend to see other societies as we're all on the equal plane, and therefore we are pretty nice, I guess you would say, compared to some mindsets around the world. But please continue.
Yeah. We're predisposed to, you know, kind of minding our own business, perhaps, or just not wanting to seem like we're the heavy, we're the bad guy, or the assertive guy. And so we've got to get out of that mindset. That's, in my view, that's first step you got to take. You know, the other thing we got to start doing a better job of is integration. You got to figure out how to bring all those pieces together. John uses the analogy of the orchestra, and that's very apt. Another thing I think you got to keep in mind is there has to be a moral dimension to this. You have to engage in moral reasoning. You cannot look at this as a purely Machiavellian, purely quasi-realist kind of mindset. It's not going to last. The American people won't put up with it, and you're not going to have any sustained success. So you've got to make the future leaders in this country stop and think about how do you take actions, especially strategically offensive actions, that are consistent with our traditional American values. You have
to be on the strategic offense. To be on the strategic offense, but without war. That's sort of a lose-lose. We want to win without war. That's the theme here today.
Absolutely. But you can go on the strategic offensive without using military force. And remember, military force has a huge role to play in this as a supporting arm. What we're talking about is war, not non-military, right? The military can always be a supportive element of a lot of things, and it does. It's just not going kinetic, right? And then the final thing I think we have to teach future leaders is something that I'm going to use a phrase that David and I had a common professor, who a man named Kerry Lord. And Kerry Lord's, he's an old friend of the Institute as well.
Written a book, I think, on the art of war, is it?
He wrote a book called The Modern Prince.
The Modern Prince, yeah.
Which is a tremendous book, and it's one of my all-time favorites. But he used to talk about the role of prudence, right? Prudence being the practical application of political virtue when it comes to international affairs. And that skill is something that really, really has disappeared in this country, among the political leadership, among policy establishment. It's it's an old-fashioned kind of, people don't want to talk about virtue, they don't want to talk about prudence. They combine prudence with hesitancy or timidity or something like that, and it's nothing like that. It's simply recognizing I've got a lot of lousy choices between, there's no perfect solution, and so what we have to do is find something that is virtuous, or at least as virtuous as we can be, but also practical, actually is going to accomplish something. And having that skill requires experience, it requires education, and it requires discipline.
Right. It requires IWP.
Well, that too.
David, go ahead.
Thanks. No, I think that's great. And, you know, having a strategic approach and a strategic mindset so that you don't have to make decisions, you know, on the fly. So doing planning, having a plan, having an integrated approach. The good thing is, you know, this, what we're talking about isn't necessarily rocket science. And these are all things that we've been able to do at times successfully in our past. So this isn't out of the American character. This isn't something that can't be done. This isn't something that, it does require leadership. You know, you do need to know, as John said, you need to know your adversaries, and then you need to have a plan to, as Frank was saying, how do you go on the offensive? Yeah. We need leadership in Congress. We need leadership in the executive branch. You're seeing some of that with Congress actually pushing the executive branch to do more on understanding the threats from China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and other strategic influence threats. So the FBI is doing a bit more in this area. So we're understanding that. Having a policy organization that can bring these elements together, either at the NSC or some other organization, that's required. I mean, we can have intelligence agencies and others carrying out some of these activities, but some of it's going to be overt. Some of it's going to be through the Commerce Department, the State Department, Treasury, law enforcement, justice, the Defense Department. Military diplomacy and training and equipping are huge activities that the military does that we could do better and coordinate it better, but that's very important to helping support friends and allies and to help build their strength and also build understanding with between countries. So, you know, but we need a policy organization, I think, to bring this together, either, again, something quick like the NSC could be done, you know, through presidential, you know, reorganization. You could get a congressionally mandated organization. Since we lost U.S. Information Agency at the end of the 1990s, we really haven't had a group that has been focused on public diplomacy. There's undersecretary within the State Department, but you don't have an independent voice who's looking out for both some of the offensive political warfare activities that we might want to do, but also the softer side, public diplomacy, helping promote the U.S. image, helping promote understanding of the U.S. And that's, I think, hugely important.
Okay, gentlemen, I'm going to go to the questions now, and we're getting a lot of good questions. I can see them in front of me. So if you don't mind, I'm going to ask questions, and you can jump in, whoever wants to answer these. All three of you don't have to answer them. So this is from Anonymous. Do you think there's a need and opportunity for a NATO-type alliance in the Pacific to counter Chinese threats? So we did have, at one point, CETO, I believe, and we have the ASEAN, which is more diplomatic. But somebody want to comment on sort of a NATO in the Pacific, how useful is that, counterproductive? Any thoughts on that, gentlemen?
Frank, you want to take it?
Oh, sure. Throw me under the bus. Sure. Happy to. Sure. Thanks for the easy one there, John. I think that's a challenging idea, not in the least because I think you're not, the countries in the region are not quite at the point where they're ready to make a jump like that. They're certainly getting closer. Over the past decade, I think the hope within the Pacific, within especially Southeast Asia, that a Chinese peaceful rise was possible. I think it's 10 years ago that was an article of faith or at least a hope. I think most countries now realize that's probably not going to happen. And so I think we're closer to that kind of organization. But I'm not convinced that a formal alliance like that is necessary. I think you're already seeing a lot of informal ones, and they're not just bilateral. You look at the Australians, the Japanese, and the Indians are working together in ways that 5 years ago would have been unthinkable.
Is that right?
You're seeing ASEAN reaching out to the United States much more vigorously on ASEAN states reaching out to the United States much more vigorously than they ever have before. And so I don't know that a provocative move like that is going to fly very well with some of the nations in the region. So I think we're better off at this point sticking to a more informal type of trilateral or multilateral type thing rather than a formal organization like NATO.
I think David has a comment on this.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I think that's a good starting point, and thank you for taking that, Frank. The U.S. is doing working on economic side, diplomatic side. I think that's going to be as important. Bilaterally, militarily, working with different countries, that may be the way to go for the near term. But the U.S. can play a role. The U.S. was important in helping bring South Korea and Japan closer together a few years ago. With the U.S. absence, their relations have started to fray a bit, and that's not good for the U.S. So, you know, the U.S. having a presence, the U.S. being engaged on all these fronts, We're working with Japan in development and economic issues. As was mentioned, also India, Australia, and the U.S. working together too. So, and this is going to Southeast Asia, but also Africa. So, you know, I think leveraging our diplomatic and economic can have a big impact, encouraging military dialogue and doing things, you know, with coalitions of the willing without necessarily a formal treaty that can go a long way.
Yeah. And, you know, this Wuhan virus, which we call COVID over here, but it came from the town of Wuhan, has really shaken up people, I think, in terms of how the Chinese behaved and the World Health Organization, et cetera. I have another question.
Well, and just one more thing. I mean, I think on that's important that you bring that up. You know, how do we take advantage of some of the Chinese missteps? And they've been very aggressive in their diplomacy and threatening countries. They were threatening Australia that wanted to do an investigation. Yeah. They've threatened Canada over the detainment and trial of the executive from Huawei. Highlighting Chinese bad behavior and just telling the truth is something that, you know, we can do as academics, but really you need someone like the U.S. government probably highlighting this for other governments and for the populations of the publics of other governments.
Michael, I wanted to mention one brief item, and that is that I think there are some sectors of what is NATO-like structures, but wouldn't be a complete sort of Southeast or, you know, South, or East Asia alliance and East Asia and Pacific alliance. But for example, during the Cold War, we had an organization called COCOM, Coordinating Committee on Multilateral Export
Control.
Yeah, which was a cooperative arrangement amongst the advanced industrial countries of the West, including Japan, for example, to prevent the transfer of sensitive technologies to the Soviet bloc. And it was designed to prevent people of one country from undercutting everybody else in order to get a market share by selling to the Soviets. And we all decided, all right, there are going to be certain technologies that we're not going to sell. And there are some of these things that we simply shouldn't be selling or letting the Chinese steal. I think we need to develop some collaborative relationships that have to be on the formal side that may not necessarily be the exact equivalent of a full-fledged military alliance.
Okay. The next question I have for you, gentlemen, is this. As we know, we actually have a ruler for life in Xi in China. There's no sense of any self-government or democratic republic, etc. And we have a very different situation where we have popular vote, picks our leadership in the House and Senate and the presidency and the Supreme Court, etc. How much of an advantage or disadvantage, or probably a little bit of both, is it for the fact that the Chinese are really unidimensional? I'm sure they have internal politics that's pretty fierce, but they don't have popular government, and we are swayed by popular sentiment. So it's really two different kinds of planets, I guess you would say.
Well, may I just observe here that the kind of government that China has today has one very important strategic advantage. It is capable of conducting a long-term strategy, whereas, as Winston Churchill said, democracies are incapable of conducting a consistent policy for anything more than about 5 years at a time. Yeah. And I think that that's a very important advantage. But another one, of course, is that they, as the Russians have been doing, play upon our public sentiment, can work on the psychological disarmament of our people and our elected leadership. They can play all kinds of propaganda and active measures games against us, which where we don't have the exact reciprocal capability. However, the one great vulnerability that they face is that, and I'm specifically talking about China here, but the same goes for North Korea, and to a little lesser extent with Russia, their fear of their own people.
Yeah.
The Chinese Communist Party fears the Chinese people more than anything. And they fear their people absorbing the truth. They fear their people absorbing democratic ideas and coming to the conclusion that their rulers are an illegitimate government. And we can take advantage of that kind of vulnerability.
All right. Thank you. David and Frank both want to comment, John. So
yes.
Go ahead. David? David, you're on mute.
So I'll let the dean go first.
No. You had your hand up first.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I think, you know, it's important to understand the Chinese government isn't all-powerful, isn't omnipotent. They have pressures too. They do things that are short-sighted. They, you know, sometimes I think we in the U.S. We sometimes do mirror imaging, which is to our detriment. But we also sometimes let our biases about, you know, what we think the other government's strengths are, maybe overmatch what they really are. And you know, they have some ability to do a longer strategic plan because they don't have some of the competing forces that we do with elections and all, but they also have internal pressures. They make mistakes. They can, act in short-sighted ways. We just need to be able to take advantage of those when they do make mistakes. And again, I think John's point was really important that when we're talking here with our conflict with, you know, the Russian government, with the Chinese government, these are with the government and their policies that are trying to have malign influence in against the U.S. and in the world community. It's not the people, and that we really need to be clear about separating that. And this is where public diplomacy, some of our information, strategic influence operations, the hardest targets that we have you know, gotten harder over the last 5 to 10 years. They've really made it so it's been harder for us to get our message and our information to these countries, just as they've expanded their activities in the U.S. and in the West. But the Soviet Union was certainly a hard target, and we were able to make inroads there. So just because something's a hard target doesn't mean we shouldn't be going after it.
Frank?
Yeah, I think I agree with a lot of what both of you have said. What I would say is every form of government has strengths and weaknesses. And when you're looking to develop your strategy, you have to understand that. And certainly the continuity that Putin has or that you have with the CCP is very important. But that's also a weakness in some ways. When you're not having fresh looks at what you're doing, it's real easy to get real stale. It's real easy to start becoming very complacent. One of the virtues of having changing administrations and churn in the White House and churn in the executive branch and the legislature is that new people are taking a look at this and new ideas are up. You have a whole think tank community that is creating these ideas. And so you have these sort of policy entrepreneurs out there who are being able to change things. The other thing I'd point out is only one guy's in charge, that's the single point of failure, right? So if you want to make these regimes squirm, start forcing that single point of failure to make 10 or 12 major strategic decisions in a very short period of time. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to screw it up. And when they do, you take advantage of it. Again, that's why you go on the offensive.
One of the takeaways is when you discourage dissent among your people, you also discourage it among your colleagues, and therefore you get a lot of groupthink. There's a book, a political science book called Groupthink back from the 1970s, I think, about that. David, I'm going to move on to another question, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay. because we have just 10 minutes left. Okay. A lot of questions. At what point would it be necessary, this is from Facebook viewer, at what point would it be necessary for the U.S. to provide weapons such as hypersonic missile technology and even nuclear technology to Taiwan to protect them against Chinese aggression? Now, that's an easy question. Anybody want to take a hit at that?
I will. 10 days after, never. There are a lot better ways to protect Taiwan than to start doing something like that. That destroys the non-proliferation policy we've had for decades. Transferring nuclear weapons to any state is a huge threat. It all but guarantees a conflict across the straits. And quite frankly, the hypersonic weapons we have, when we field them, are not things we want being leaked around. And so now there are a lot of other things we can do to protect Taiwan, and we should be doing those. And not all of those are military in nature. Again, getting back to the winning without war. But I don't see an upside to doing that.
Okay. Other comments, or I'll go to the next one. Okay. All right. So here's another one from Facebook. Do you think that the measures that the U.S. has implemented against the dictatorship in Venezuela and Nicaragua will be enough to drive those regimes out of power, or will we have to use military force? Okay, David?
Well, economic sanctions alone probably aren't going to be enough. But I'm certainly not advocating military force here. It's going to be up to the people. We can help encourage the people. We can do a lot through information sharing, training possibly, working with allies and partners, you know, cutting off some of their international support. That's going to be important. There's lots of ways to have influence without using the military. I'd argue that while Venezuela was a high profile for a while, we've been sporadic in our application of these different instruments of statecraft that we've been talking about. And, you know, it's all, you know, it goes back to what Frank was talking about with prudence and our national interests. You have to take into account our national interests and how much we're going to exert towards these different international problems. We can't be the, you know, policemen of the world. We have interests around the world. How do we respond in an appropriate manner? That's where a strategic approach, I think, is, and having an integrated strategy and linking your strategy with your moral position and with your national interests. That allows you to have a clear definition and be able to clearly articulate and then execute your policies.
Okay. I've got another question here about NATO. You know, the current president, Mr. Trump, had made quite an issue of 2% of GDP spending on defense. And I think because of that, some countries have stepped up to that responsibility. But the questioner asked, do you think NATO at its current state of readiness is strong enough as an alliance, or should we do something to improve it? Any comments on NATO in 2020?
Frank?
You know, just because you're my boss doesn't mean you get the... sure. You know, any alliance, maybe alliances are like marriages, they can always be stronger. I think that there is a lot to complain about NATO, and we've, you know, this administration is certainly not the first to complain about the lack of budgetary support and so on. I think that is in many cases an overstatement. We gain quite a bit from NATO, quite apart from whether every nation is kicking in the promised percentage or not. I think there's a lot of things we can do better. The first thing which is goes back to the threats I alluded to at the beginning of this, which is to address some of the political inroads that the Russians have made into the alliance itself, whether it's, again, placing pressure on a number of the Eastern European states, inroads in attempts to influence Greece, attempts to influence Turkey. Those sort of political efforts are much more dangerous to the long-term stability of the alliance than a budgetary problem. That is a manageable issue. Yes, I'd love to see the Europeans spend more. No, they're not spending anywhere near enough. No, they're not taking their military instrument seriously enough. But there's other things that we gain from there.
Right. Can I just comment on NATO? Number one, if it didn't exist, we'd probably want to create it. So I think it's good in that sense. Number two, I think our adversaries would love to have such a international alliance of 20-some nations who meet and have a headquarters in Brussels, et cetera. David, you have some comments on that?
Well, just I do think that, you know, with this COVID crisis, the pandemic, it's causing economic disruptions. It's going to be an economic downturn, recession for large parts of the world. That's going to exacerbate some of the tensions on military defense spending. That's going to require a better strategic approach. We're going to have to be, we had the luxury of having strategic depth, having the ability to spend money, use the military, spend down even some of the military advancements we're living off of from the 80s. It's going to be a different environment in some ways, and we're going to need a better strategic approach. And if the countries that seem to do well with strategy are those that, you know, have one shot to get things right, or they may face severe consequences. So, you know, we're not going to have quite the luxury that we had in the past, I think, just going forward for defense spending and issues. So, you know, again, we need to keep our defense spending up and our military strong. But to me, this argues that we need to redevelop our strategic culture so that we can have an integrated approach, so that we don't have to get into these costly conflicts. We can shape the international environment in ways that are advantageous to us and our allies without actually having to resort to the military. And I think that can be done more cheaply through public diplomacy, economic statecraft, information. But we need to invest in people and education and leaders that can exercise and do these things.
Michael, I wanted to just observe that one of the greatest weaknesses I see in the Western Alliance is civilizational fatigue, both in Europe and to a certain extent here in the United States, where substantial numbers of people seem alienated from the societies that they inherited. They are in Europe, particularly. You have significant parts of the population who seem to be enjoying life, and in the process, not having children, committing demographic suicide, not even having enough demographic strength to be able to maintain a labor force, depending upon immigration from parts of the world which are not interested, such as some of these so-called refugees from the Middle East, who are not interested in assimilating into those countries and becoming part of Europe, but instead have created separatist enclaves, which I think are going to be incredibly deadly for the future ability of many European countries to maintain unity and sufficient cultural strength in order to defend themselves.
Okay, excellent. I'm going to close up now because we just have a couple minutes left. So we thank the audience for joining us today. So we thank John and David and Frank for being our discussions today. We've been reminded of the challenges of our age the age that America today faces. And my IWP colleagues have shown how thoughtful and innovative we have to be and how they are as teachers at this very special institute in Washington, D.C., at the corner of 16th and Church Street. If you want to visit our wonderful headquarters. We have master's and doctoral programs. It's a wonderful small college. Anybody that is an undergraduate or is thinking about graduate school, for diplomats, warriors, and spies, we're your solution. So please check our website, iwp.edu. Their biographies are on there. The courses are listed, all those sort of things. To be continued, we'll have another set of these, but we want to thank again our audience and our discussants today on behalf of our republic in keeping it very strong. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.